It's been nearly 20 years since the last episode of The West Wing aired on television. And yet, millions of Americans continue to watch the series. The Aaron Sorkin show idealized life inside the White House and inspired a generation of political operatives. Today, it's the subject of a new book called What's Next. The title comes from fictional President Jed Bartlett. And the book is a behind-the-scenes look at the creation and the legacy of The West Wing, written by two former cast members. Melissa Fitzgerald played Carol Fitzpatrick, press secretary to C.J. Craig's assistant, and Mary McCormack, who was deputy national security advisor Kate Harper. Melissa, Mary, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having us.
I'm going to be honest. I have loved The West Wing since it first aired when I was in high school.
And yay!
Although I didn't know I was a wing nut until I read the book. I didn't realize that was the nickname for our super fans of the show.
It's pretty good, right?
It is. It fits. When I got married and I got my husband into the show, it was a love me, love The West Wing kind of deal. And the series about the lives of White House staffers has become one of our comfort watches. I think it's because the show about the people who work in the government and politics is a show about people who are fundamentally good, who believe in public service and are trying to do what they believe is right. Essentially, The West Wing is how we want the government to operate. Do you feel like that's why we keep coming back to it over and over again? Because I'm like, this is how I wish politics was.
I think so. I do think we meet people all the time who are like, I had to watch it again this year.
Yeah.
they look like addicts. You know, they're like,
I just needed a fix.
Yeah. They're like, I just finished it again. You know, it's my 16th time. And I think there is a tonic quality to the show, right? In this time of, you know, sometimes despair, it feels a bit like an antidote.
And the people that work in that White House, whether they agree, you know, you have people on both sides of the aisle who were working together and sometimes fighting together, but it was always to do the most good for the most people. They believed in their perspective and that was best. I think the other reason people keep coming back to the show is that it's just great television. Aaron Sorkin's unreasonable talent. I mean, when I read that pilot, which was over a year before it went on the air, I'd never read anything like that before or since, frankly. And I was naive. I know Mary had done a lot more work than I had at that time, but I think I was a little naive. And even though a political show had never in the history of network television been successful, I was convinced that there is no denying that much talent that, you know, Aaron Sorkin.
You begin the book with how the show came about. And I love that the story actually begins in 1995 with the movie The American President. For those who don't know, it follows a fictional president whose wife has died and he falls in love again. And Aaron Sorkin wrote that movie and interviewed dozens of real White House staffers. And he basically just had a lot of material left over, but he didn't want to write a television show at first.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we talk about it in What's Next, and that scene, you know, he and his friend, great screenwriter Akiva Goldsman, were having dinner, and I think Aaron and Akiva went down for a cigarette break to his basement, and the poster of The American President was there, and Aaron was having lunch with John Wells, a storied television producer, and he said, you know, I'm having lunch with him, and yeah, I don't really want to write television, but Akiva said, you know, it would make a great show is that, and pointed to the American President poster. And I think that's where it all began, right, Mary?
It's where it all began. And Aaron writes the foreword of our book and tells that story.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were so grateful that he did that for us too. That was great.
Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't an easy sell either. It seems wild to me now, but West Wing really paved the way for an entire genre of political television. It's hard to imagine that, like, a politics show wouldn't sell, but I guess back then, I mean, Bill Clinton's sex scandal was still really fresh in our minds. Like, Watergate wasn't that far in the distant past. Like, the White House didn't have the greatest reputation.
And also, it had never been done successfully. I mean, I think that is a real deterrent for any television executive. This has never been done successfully before.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Right. Now we know a lot more about politics. You know, I mean, the words the West Wing, people weren't really familiar with, never mind POTUS or any of
yeah.
that kind of insider's gaze at it had never really been done. And we didn't have 24-hour news channels. We weren't, you know, so it was a different time.
Yeah.
But people championed it, took a risk on it. You had, you know, John Wells had a great deal already. So he was, you know, he really wanted to make it happen. Aaron Sorkin's ridiculously great script. And Peter Roth, who was the head of Warner Brothers Television at the time. And I think Scott Sessa, they, you know, they really championed the West Wing. And it, thank goodness for all of us, got on the air.
Yeah. I don't know that you could do the West Wing now, though, on network, certainly, because it's so nuanced. You know, I don't know that. I mean, I think like Scandal's fun. It's a different ride and it's less nuanced. Like, I think I don't know that the West Wing would live on network now. It would probably have to.
And in fact, remember Peter Roth told us, and it's in the book, that his original thought was that it go to HBO.
Mm.
And that, because he didn't think that like NBC would take it. And then sure enough, the opposite happened.
Yeah. The joke I've always heard is that the West Wing is how we hope politics operates. House of Cards or Scandal is how we fear it really does. And Veep and Veep is probably how it actually works.
Well, I hope that's not true. And I don't think that's true. It's certainly not in my experience. And I live in Washington, D.C. And, you know, Mary and I know a lot of people that work in government. And most of the people we know and work with are phenomenal and are incredibly bright, talented, committed, passionate, who really sacrificed to work in public service. And so they inspire us and inspire me every single day. And they could be doing lots of other things for lots more money. And they choose to work in public service because they care. But one of them is Congressman Brendan Boyle from Philadelphia. And he told us, and it's in What's Next. He says, you know, my staff will often ask, are we having a House of Cards Day or a West Wing Day?
Hopefully more West Wing than House of Cards days.
Yes.
So part of the book is just that behind the scenes look for the super fan. And I want to talk about that first. And then I want to talk about how service has really been a through line in your lives and in the show. But I loved learning about how the cast came together. The West Wing is fundamentally a show about the administration of Jed Bartlett, played by Martin Sheen. But to me, it's always felt like an ensemble cast, like Friends or Seinfeld, where all of the characters are so great and really play off one another. And one of the things I loved about the book was learning how each actor got their part. Chief of Staff Leo McGarry was apparently very easy to cast, which made absolute sense to me. Anyone who's seen John Spencer in the show couldn't imagine Leo being anyone else.
That's for sure.
Yeah. And we had some great access. John Levy, the casting director, gave us all of his casting books, which are huge. And he told us about John Spencer's audition. I think they had originally said, well, we want to get a John Spencer type. And then I think it was Tommy, right, who said, well, why don't we get John Spencer? So John Spencer came into audition and John Levy was in his office. And he said, if not for the photos on my desk of my kids, we could have like aired his audition. It was that good.
And if you've never seen the West Wing show, here is one of my favorite Leo McGarry scenes about a really big block of cheese.
You're still going to do the speech?
Got to.
Yeah.
Little thing called team morale, Josh. You got to make people feel good about themselves.
All right. Shut the hell up, everybody. I fired more people than you before breakfast. Andrew Jackson, in the main foyer of the White House, had a big block of cheese. The block of cheese was huge.
Leo, who made these assignments?
I think this will go faster if I'm not interrupted, don't you?
I'm meeting with the Organization of Cartographers for Social Equality.
Yes.
What do map makers have to do with social equality?
I guess you're about to find out.
Well, probably not, because I won't really be listening to them.
The block of cheese was huge.
Excuse me, Leo. CJ, I got NIH research funding for cancer treatment using shark cartilage, if you want to trade.
I'll take that.
What do you got?
Citizens for DC statehood.
Forget it.
I've got the Kempsford Lee Sea Turtle Society, but I'm keeping it.
You're all keeping it. I'm sure Margaret worked long and hard to make sure that the appropriate petitioner went to the appropriate staffer.
The big block of cheese is kind of iconic of the West Wing, and there's more than one episode about it, but it's just that switch of, I don't know, there's something about him where I'm like, that's the chief of staff.
Yeah.
We really missed him. That was a huge loss to us when John passed.
I imagine. I feel like it's safe to say, because it's been out, you know, for so long, the last episode aired almost 20 years ago, that his passing gets written into the end of the series, and it is incredibly sad.
Yeah, it was impossible not to really work it into the end.
Yeah. In that clip, in that clip, you also hear Deputy Chief of Staff Josh Lineman, who was played by actor Bradley Whitford. And he got the job of Josh by demanding to be Josh and not another character named Sam Seaborn. And honestly, as like a super fan of the show, I'm like, no, Bradley Whitford is not Sam.
Yeah.
Not Sam.
Brad knew.
God, he knew it.
Yeah. I do love the very sort of frank honesty that he was told. He was not funny, nor was he sexy, and therefore he did not fit the character that he was hoping to get.
Can you imagine anyone saying that about Brad Whitford? Not funny, not sexy. He is both funny and sexy.
The other reason I chose the big block of cheese scene is because it also highlights one of the real challenges of being on an Aaron Sorkin show, and that's the dialogue. It is fast-paced, quick, complicated terms, complex sentences, obscure references to art and music and history. And what was really fascinating to me, and I'd never really considered it, is that there are some really talented actors who just cannot get his dialogue out of their mouths.
That's for sure. I mean, some of the best actors just don't speak that way. It's really musical. You know, Aaron, we never change any words. Aaron's lines, you say exactly word for word. And recently we were having a book event, and Aaron came and spoke, and I thought it was so interesting because he said, I just want to, for the record, say, I'm not, I don't think my words are so precious that you can never change them. It's not born out of that. It's born out of music. He said, for me, the way I write, it's just like music. Like, I hear it, there's a rhythm and I hear it. And if you change a word, the rhythm is a different rhythm. It's just sort of broken. And it made total sense. You know, that's the way he writes. And it is the way it sounds too, when you listen to dialogue. But not every actor could do it. Sometimes a guest actor would come in and, you know, you rehearse it and we would just all look at each other like, oh God, oh no, oh no. Like they just don't speak that music. And then, most of the time people would come in and they did speak that music, but it's sort of an odd, it's like, can you curl your tongue or not? It doesn't have to do with if you're a good actor or not.
Talent. It was also interesting when we interviewed a few of sort of incredibly talented guest actors, and they shared stories of their first couple days and how, you know, Aaron had said to them, well, you go ahead and make it your own. And they assumed that he meant you can change a word here and there, make it more conversational for yourselves. You can on almost every other television show, but not this one. And so I think it was Oliver Platt who just, you know, Stalker Channing told us he went white when she said, no, you can't change a word.
For a word, right? And it was tons of material.
The night before he was supposed to shoot his scenes. And it's challenging. We had somebody on the team whose sole job, you know, Hillary Griffiths, her sole job was to make sure you were letter perfect. And usually that's the script supervisor, which we also had, but we needed an extra person just for that.
Yeah, another one that I loved, Mary, was that Toby Ziegler's character for a moment might have been Eugene Levy of Schitt's Creek fame. And it just did not work out that way.
The casting stuff was really fun. I mean, we got, because we were on the show, we do have incredible access. Like this book is for Wingnuts, a really deep look inside because we were part of the cast. So, you know, John Levy wouldn't have given his casting folders to a reporter.
Just anyone,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, but he did to us, which was so generous, but it really was incredible information in there. I mean, never mind the Toby role, but all the roles, like who they were considering for each role, your brain just goes crazy. And there's so much more. I mean, we have lists of possible presidents, and lists of, you know, just brainstorming ideas. And some of them are completely cuckoo. Like,
oh yeah. Like he should have been like a race car driver, or like there was all these
Steinbrenner, or Jesse Jackson was on the list. I mean,
James Carville.
Johnny Carson. I mean, like they were just putting anyone on that list. It was nuts. And then there's a list of female actresses as if the president were going to be a woman, which was crazy back then.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still crazy. So I guess we haven't nailed that yet.
Not that crazy.
Maybe if they ever reboot The West Wing, it'll be with a female president.
Yeah, maybe we can do it in real life.
We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, how a commitment to service has kept the cast of The West Wing close since the show ended. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about The West Wing this hour, the show that made arcane federal rules and political procedure into must-see TV. Still with me are the authors of a new book, What's Next? It gives readers a peek into what life was like in the fictional administration of Jed Bartlet. The authors are former cast members, Melissa Fitzgerald, who played Carol, the press secretary's assistant, and Mary McCormick, who was deputy national security advisor Kate Harper. Melissa, part of the magic of this show for someone like me who has made a career covering politics was watching your writers turn a filibuster or getting enough votes to pass a bill into suspenseful plot lines. The show has been described as a civics lesson, and I think in a lot of ways it is, but it's just so compelling. Like the Stackhouse filibuster is an amazing episode.
For sure. I mean, Aaron Sorkin has talked about it a lot in general, but also in What's Next, he really shares that, you know, yeah, sure, it can be a civics lesson, but you can't get a civic lesson if nobody's watching, and it has to be great television. And he talks a lot about that it was an hour a week, an opportunity to tell good stories. And he did that. And then, you know, after he left, John Wells and the writing team continued to do that, to tell great stories. Because at the end of the day, if people aren't watching, nobody's getting that civics lesson. So I think
our shows used to be, I mean, pre this, were always about or often set in hospitals, courtrooms, right. Precincts, you know, wherever, because to sustain an hour of television, the stakes have to be high. There really has to be, it can't be sort of small stories. They have to be life and death stories. So it is a chance. I mean, it's only in Aaron's hands that how do you translate life and death to a filibuster story, you know, to wonky policy stuff. Yeah. But I think that the sort of the leap is that policy is life and death. For so many people, you know, and that's the connection that he is able to make in The West Wing, which is really lovely.
Critical. And I think that's critical for us to remember now, because policy is what impacts people's lives. And I think there has been an enormous disconnect between policy and people's lives. And I think if we are to have any hope at all, we need to connect that again. And, you know, Brad Whitford often says that politics is how we create our moral vision. And I think that is absolutely true. It's not politics, it's values and how we decide we are going to, as a nation, take care of each other and especially take care of those who are struggling and suffering.
And it's had real world impacts, not just in the spawning of 1,000 political operatives who wanted to be the next Sam Seaborn or Josh Lyman or Kate Harper, but you know what's fascinating, Mary, is that your character's fictional proposal for peace in the Middle East was actually published by the Jewish Journal of Greater Los Angeles as the Harper Plan. Like, they actually put it out there.
Yeah, I mean, incredible. John Wells is really something, because he, you know, that was in the final breath of the show. And I don't think, I'm sure when he brought that story to the network, they weren't like, yes. Let's definitely do the Middle East, you know, and he's amazing.
And a terrorist attack in the Middle East.
Yeah. Oh. No, exactly. He's really something. I mean, he's he just didn't care. Like, he's like, I want to tell stories that really matter, and had the capital to do it and spent it, which is, I really love him for that. I mean, I did an arc on ER with him. He produced that as well. And I was a Red Cross worker, and we did multiple episodes about, you know, genocide in the Congo. And then we did a Sudan's Darfur story. And, you know, I mean, it's just, that's who John Wells is, really something. Yeah. But I mean,
and how lucky were we to get to be part of all those stories, and you know, so fortunate.
And you watch the characters really struggle. You know, CJ Craig, the press secretary, struggles with how to frame some of the genocide and the, in these African countries. Obviously, Toby Ziegler has leaks classified information, ultimately gets in a whole lot of trouble. The characters themselves struggle with the ethical issues.
Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, that's what
keeps it's human.
Yeah.
And it's human. I mean, I worked in a war zone in Uganda, and I had a couple struggles, you know, with, you know, when we were deciding who gets what services, and it, you know, it's difficult.
Yeah.
I think the most enduring or perhaps most endearing part of the show, at least for me, were some of President Bartlett's speeches, because he spoke in a way that I think we all want a president to speak. And here is one of my particular favorite speeches, which seems unfortunately timely given the school shooting in Georgia.
Securing peace in a time of global conflict, sustaining hope in this winter of anxiety and fear. More than any time in recent history, America's destiny is not of our own choosing. We did not seek, nor did we provoke, an assault on our freedom and our way of life. We did not expect, nor did we invite, a confrontation with evil. Yet the true measure of a people's strength is how they rise to master that moment when it does arrive. 44 people were killed a couple of hours ago at Kennison State University. Three swimmers from the men's team were killed, and two others are in critical condition when, after having heard the explosion from their practice facility, they ran into the fire to help get people out. Ran into the fire. The streets of heaven are too crowded with angels tonight. There are students and our teachers and our parents and our friends. The streets of heaven are too crowded with angels. But every time we think we've measured our capacity to meet a challenge, we look up and we're reminded that that capacity may well be limitless. This is a time for American heroes. We will do what is hard. We will achieve what is great. This is a time for American heroes, and we reach for the stars. God bless their memory. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
That speech gets me every single time I hear
us
it.
Us too, and we put it in the book because of that. We did sort of a mashup at the end of the book of a bunch of his iconic speeches and lines to really motivate service. And this is the time for American heroes. And, you know, knowing that our capacity is limitless, that certainly gives me hope.
It's exactly what you want to hear from what we call the comforter in chief after a tragedy. It's just every time I listen to it, I think that's why I keep rewatching it, because I'm like, oh, that's good. It's soothing great. In a way.
Yeah. And we, Martin joined us at one of our live book events here in Washington, D.C., and he read that final speech that's in the book out loud. And it's available online. But it was, he brought the house down with that.
Mary, I have to say, I am so happy to have read that Martin Sheen is just as good a human off screen as Bartlett was on the screen. You guys write that he really set the tone for the cast on the set. Can you kind of talk about how he made sure, there were so many great examples, like eating lunch with everyone, saying hello and introducing to himself. Yeah. Seems like a good guy.
Oh my, it's beyond good guy. I mean, he's really, and he would shut this right down. He's so humble. He would not want to hear this. We had to write the book. We didn't show him the book as we were writing it because we thought he'll never allow this. So we made sure it was finished, and then we sent it to him. And he said, "Too late, you can't change it."
Yeah,
he's just—he's the greatest. I mean, we all look up to him. He's kind. He's compassionate. He's an activist. He's humble. I'll let Melissa tell this story because it is was a really formative story for her, and in the retelling to me, and really one of the reasons we wrote the book, sort of a jumping off point. But what it was her first impression of Martin. You know, he's number one on the call on a call on a production. There's always a call sheet, which is a list of all the actors, and they each have a number, and the list of what you're going to do that day, the scene numbers, what's needed, props. Like it's basically marching orders for the entire crew. And so the lead of the show is usually number one. So they call him number one. So, and there's an expression in television, and it is, as number one goes, so goes the show, which means like, if they're nice guy, if it's someone nice and professional and on time and, you know, kind to the crew, then the whole thing is sort of easier and nicer and more respectful, but it's not always the case. But so anyway, we were lucky with Martin beyond. I mean, that's an understatement, but I'll let Melissa tell this other story because it's hers.
And we have a chapter in What's Next called Number One of Number Ones, because that's how we all feel about Martin. And we did hundreds of interviews for this book, hundreds, and well over 100, I should say. And we couldn't find one single person to say one single bad thing about Martin Sheen. Everyone was going, and that's why we created that chapter. We didn't set out to have that chapter. It just happened because we had so many good things. We had to have its own chapter. But one of my very, very, very first days at work, it was a day that had a lot of background artists that are often on sets not treated particularly well and eat different food than everybody else in a different place than everybody else. They're called extras, which I think is kind of a demeaning term because they're not at all extra. They are critical to creating the reality of the world. And on our show, they were referred to as background artists. And Martin came onto set. There was a scene with lots of background artists. And I was in that scene. And I remember him walking onto set. And the producers are over here and background's over here. And I see Martin go over and start shaking every single person's hand, introducing himself, and not just introducing, connecting with each and every single person. And, you know, TikTok, we're about to start, we're all standing there. And the producers are like, you know, kind of looking at their watches a little bit. And I was saying, oh my gosh, what's happening here? And then it just dawned on me that Martin is, and I'm not saying he was conscious of this, this is just who he is at his core. But I thought, he's teaching all of us how this is going to go down from here on out, that this is going to be a set where we respect everybody, no matter what their role is, because everybody's role is important. People will be treated with dignity and respect. Their work will be honored. And that was absolutely true. And, you know, the background have different food in different place. And Martin said, no, we all are going to eat together because families eat together. And I feel like that was, and Mary and I have talked about this so much, such a critical thing for creating the West Wing family. And we really are a family. 25 years later, you know, Mary and I are on a text chain with the cast, and, you know, we text every single day. I mean, I think there's rarely a day that there's not a text. Yeah. Often it's a request to do a service-oriented project together, and everybody jumps in when they can. Like,
or we're making fun of Josh Molina.
That too.
you know, replacing...
Oh, don't feel badly for Josh Molina. He gives way better than he gets.
I was going to say, I mean, replacing Sam Seaborn had to be hard.
Not for Josh Molina.
Yeah, I mean, you get that family vibe, too, from the photographs. So in the book, in two different sections, there are all these incredible behind-the-scenes photographs, including one of you, Mary, with a rosary that Martin gave you for the birth of your first child. It's a very sweet photo.
Yeah, Martin is Martin will get some rosaries blessed, and you, if you're lucky and need one, you all of a sudden he's putting it in your hand. And so, yeah, I brought it into delivery with me. It's so sweet. He's the best.
Yeah. Go ahead, Melissa. No, I was just saying about the rosary. It's not really religious. You know, he's given it to people of all different faiths. It's really about love. And a dear friend of mine she passed away 2 months ago. She had pancreatic cancer, and he gave her a rosary and called her on the phone. And he didn't know her prior to that, but he spent a lot of time with her. And he said, you know, Shannon, go through and hold each bead of that rosary and think of someone you love and someone who loves you. Then move on to the next one. And by the time you get around the rosary, you will be lifted up by love. You know, he's not like proselytizing or sending anyone to a particular religion. It's the religion of love. And that is who Martin Sheen is.
Yeah.
Just the most giving, kind, loving man.
Well, in the end of the series, Melissa lost a really dear friend to addiction. And Martin is who introduced Melissa to the work she's doing. You have to tell that because...
Yeah. Thank you, Mary, for bringing that up.
The work Melissa does is so incredible, but it is also incredible that Martin was doing that work long before anyone cared about justice reform. Like when people were just like, prisoners, addicts, thumbs down, you know, long before anyone had a thought about that, Martin was, of course, doing that work. And so
on the front lines.
Yeah. But explain
for over 30 years, for over 30 years.
That work is, though,
so, you know, for decades, people with substance use and mental health disorders were being incarcerated and coming in and out of the system, being released, coming back. And, you know, there obviously is a better way. Treatment courts are that better way. And Martin was championing them long before other people were championing. Now, treatment courts are the most studied, most successful criminal justice model in the history of our country. They are the marriage of public health and public safety. And Martin, I lost a dear friend to addiction, and Martin invited me to come with him to the national conference of the organization that I now work for and have been for almost 11 years called All Rise. And at All Rise, we advance justice system reform for individuals impacted by substance use, mental health disorders, promoting treatment and recovery support instead of incarceration. And these courts save lives. They reunite families, they make our community safer, and they actually save taxpayer dollars. So they're sort of win, 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 win. And they get support from both sides of the aisle, but Martin was right in there.
It's bipartisan because it works.
Yeah.
And I think you'd be hard pressed to find a family in our country who has not been touched by addiction. And this is an enormous problem that we face as a nation. And it is one that I'm so grateful that I get to work on, number one, but also that you see both sides of the aisle coming together to solve the problem, to save lives. And I do think that that is a nice model for other issues and things that problems that we are facing in our country. But Martin's the one who brought me there. Martin has stayed involved. He's supported me and the work that we do continuously. And Mary has been a rock star in terms of that. And every single other cast member of the West Wing has, for the entire almost 11 years that I've been working on, they've showed up with videos on Capitol Hill at our conferences doing so much that also inspired the book. I couldn't do the work that I do in the same way with the same success without them. And I am like so moved to be able to walk through this process
so
with
lucky.
Their love and support.
Melissa is like our leader, really. I mean, she is.
Not true.
It is true. Everyone says
Joe, it is not true.
She was not the boss. Allison Janney was her boss, but Allison always says in real life, Melissa's her boss. Because when Melissa raises, you know, her work is incredible. She's incredible at it. And it's hard not to get behind what she's up to. It's just, you know, I've been to graduations and treatment courts, and it is the most moving thing to watch, you know, to watch someone get a second chance who deserves it, you know, through no fault of their own, has an illness and isn't a hardened criminal and shouldn't become one by being incarcerated. It is literally, it's like a no-brainer.
And just being able to travel around the country, which I have been able to do these past 10 years, and meet people who've gone through these court programs and, you know, who've been in the deepest depths of addiction, find hope and recovery and thrive. And, you know, Mary's sister is on our board because Mary's sister was the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court of Michigan.
Oh, my goodness.
My dad was on the State Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, which is just a crazy coincidence. But both of them have worked championing treatment courts just separately. So Mary's sister, Bridget, is just such a hero of mine. And my dad also is a hero of mine. I've gotten to work with both of them on treatment courts. And, you know, just seeing people get their lives back and seeing people who work in the courts, like my dad, like Bridget, say, working in a treatment court's been the highlight of my career in criminal justice because people get better.
Yeah, it works.
It works.
Yeah, we did an incredibly emotional show recently about sex trafficking, and we have a catch court here in Franklin County. And yeah, we had one of the graduates on, definitely, like, just hearing, it was such an incredible story because she's married now, she has little children, and she's just...
And that's not an exception. I mean, it's exceptional, but it's not unusual. This happens every single day. And you have, in Ohio, over 200 treatment courts across the state. And I've been there many times. I've been to Cuyahoga County. They have some really great ones. And Judge Sinnenberg is there, and she's wonderful. But, you know, they work. Shout out. But also, I just have to brag on Mary for a second, too, because you know, Mary was the perfect person to work, you know, for us to work together on this, because Mary really, there's nobody who's able to rally people around, like motivate people and get people together around issues and causes. She's incredibly effective, has a huge heart, and she's bossy, which is a great combination.
Really, the answer why we wrote it, we're the bossiest.
That's great. Coming up. The legacy of the West Wing and the future of American politics. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
All Sides is back with a new season of Untangle. This time, we're tackling redistricting, that complicated process of deciding which lawmakers get to represent which Ohioans. Voters are being asked to change the rules for redistricting this November. It's the fifth time in 20 years this question has come before us. So we figured we should probably untangle why. Subscribe to Untangled wherever you get your podcasts and listen live Mondays at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Stever. We're talking this hour with the authors of the book What's Next? A backstage pass to the political show The West Wing. The authors and former castmates are Melissa Fitzgerald, who played Press Secretary C.J. Craig's assistant, Carol Fitzpatrick, and Mary McCormack, who played Deputy National Security Advisor Kate Harper. The West Wing was a show about an ideal Democratic administration, but there were definitely memorable Republicans who weren't the villains. I personally loved Arnold Vinnick, who runs for president in the final season. He is just an objectively great political character. I also have a real soft spot for White House counsel Ainsley Hayes. So oh,
listen to you, little secret.
Yeah.
I mean, Nick Harper voted for Vinnick, so you don't have to come to me.
Yeah.
and we love both of them as characters and as actors and as people. We just had a lovely conversation with Alan Alda on his podcast, Clear and Vivid, the other day. And what an incredible human being. My gosh, inspirational. And then also Emily Proctor, who played Ainsley Hayes, such a great person, and she's doing great work in the world now. And, you know, I encourage people to read our book and really do a deep dive in the service stories, because they're interesting. You know, her work is inspirational too. So
It's not just a peek into how the show came together. It's a peek into who you all are as people.
That's good.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes sense, because that was the motivation for the book in a way. It was like, we have this great relationship and great friendships that are really, you know, the glue, I believe, and Mary believes, the glue of those friendships is service. That's what's kept us coming back together over the years. I mean, of course, we also love being together and love each other so much. But I do think doing service together strengthens any relationship. And we've done so much of it because we've been so lucky to get the chance to do that. And Mary, you talk about that a lot, about, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Brad, I forget when he said it, it was after the pilot, I can't remember, but Anthony Edwards, who plays one of the doctors on ER, said to Brad, you're about to inherit like a lot, you're about to get a lot of capital, and you can spend it on yourself or you can spend it on others. And it is, we're so, and it's true. I mean, Brad certainly walks that walk, like he is incredibly.
Unbelievably.
But we are all, we feel lucky, you know, I mean, we all feel lucky, you know, look, actors, sports figures, anyone sort of in the public eye gets opportunity to show up for things and to throw their hat in and make a difference pretty easily. And the West Wing cast gets it, I think, even more because of the nature of the show. Mm-hmm. And it feels like an honor. We feel really lucky to be able to show up, and we love each other. So we get to sort of show up and do service together, which is even more fun.
Yeah, and one of the things I like about the show, particularly in this day and age, is that the characters get in trouble more than once for being too partisan, too focused on winning at all costs. It happens to Brad's character, Josh Lyman, more than once. And it also happens to Halfley, the Speaker of the House, in the shutdown episode. So I love that idea that, you know, winning at all costs is detrimental to democracy. And you really walk away from the show with that ideal.
Yeah, that compromise is valuable, period. And that is sort of how it's supposed to work. I mean, Aaron, at that same book event that we had recently, was asked, could the West Wing, could a reboot work now? And he said, I think it could, except for one thing. And he said that there's no reasonable Republicans anymore. You know, I think that whether that's true or not, it is, and I think on both sides, there is a tendency now to want to win at all costs, to want to shut down good policy just to win, to put the point in our column, you know, and that is, I think, scary, depressing and scary, because that is
detrimental to democracy. You know, like I just saying about the work that I do, I think we are so successful because we work together with both sides of the aisle, and we have to do that. We are facing enormous problems in our country and in the world. We need all the talent, we need compromise. And I was thinking about this in terms of writing this book, Mary. You know, there definitely have been moments where we've disagreed about things and seen things differently. But more times than not, like there are a few times we said, well, I don't care as much as you do about this, so we'll do that. But mostly what we did is we worked together to come up with something that made us both happy. And I can't think of a time where that didn't end up being better for the book. It just was better.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do think, though, that we're at risk for losing that understanding in politics.
Yeah.
So I do think that's the danger, right?
That's probably why it's my comfort watch.
Yeah, it's a lot of people's, you know, it's, yeah. And even in the West Wing, you believe that all of the characters, Democrats and Republicans, really did believe their policy was the best, was going to do the most good for the most people. They believed that policy was the thing that would work. And now, you know, it does seem at times with the sort of crazy, divided, vitriolic, you know, conversation that's happening, it does feel like we're losing that understanding of that compromise.
I mean, I think we've lost that understanding for the past bit. I do feel, and again, I'm like super optimistic and maybe naive, but I'm like
storm cloud and you're like rainbow.
But I also feel like we live in a democracy. We, the voters, have all the power and we have to exercise it and fight for it and demand it and like build it. And if we've abdicated that responsibility and we've become apathetic, then bad things happen. We got to get back in the game. That's my my feeling.
Yeah.
And if we all get back in the game, then we'll get what we want.
Yeah, I also love that the characters got to be human. I mean, it feels weird to say that I love that Josh struggled after being shot. But what I really mean is, like, I love to see him portrayed as someone who didn't bounce back from a very traumatic event, who had PTSD, who needed help, who sort of like blew up in a way that was dangerous because he was really suffering. Mm-hmm. Because that's the truth of how, of what happens to a lot of people in traumatic situations.
For sure. And television, that never used to be the case. Like, you know, the next, it would sort of all get wrapped up in the end of an episode. So yeah, that's a credit to the writing, I think.
And that episode, Noelle.
About Brad's performance too. Which
yeah, is so it's a really difficult episode to watch, but it's fantastic.
Yeah, it was. And Brad is such a like funny, light on his feet, agile creature in the world, and so for him to feel broken is really beautiful, really moving.
I have to say, though, the behind-the-scenes photo of Bradley Whitford from the day you filmed the shooting scene is wild. It is worth buying the book just to see that photo, because obviously that's a really serious and difficult scene, but it's such a funny photo. There's I'm not going to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it.
I wish we could have done more photos. We have so many.
And Mary fought to get the two photo inserts, because usually they only want to give you one, but these were our personal photos. These are from our personal collections. These aren't like, you know, photos that we got from studio or whatever.
No, they're great.
These are our personal.
Yeah, like, and we drove around to everyone's house and I was like, just show me what the photo drawer is. I'll look for them. You know, because it's all we're all old. So it's all that generation of like you printed the photos.
And yeah.
The
floor, for sure. This was pre-cell phone photos.
Right. Yeah. And they're so great. Mary really fought to have those two inserts. And I'm so glad you fought so hard for that.
Well,
Mary,
I did,
it was the right thing.
I know for me, when I go into a bookstore and it's a fun book like that, like a fan book or
something,
I flip right to the photos.
Yeah.
And they show people being real on set and off set. We have a lot of behind the scenes, like behind the scenes in our personal lives photos too, that maybe shouldn't be out there. A couple of them.
You also have a very sweet picture. One of the last pictures taken of John Spencer, and it's with his dog, and it's just the most adorable photo.
I think it is the last.
Yeah.
His dog Zoe, by the way.
That's right.
The book also gives you a real chance to learn about a lot of different charities. Charities maybe you've heard of. Charities maybe you've never heard of. I am so curious how you decided to blend this, like, you know, Aaron Sorkin calls it a love letter to public service. And in a way, the book is both a love letter to the show and to public service at the same time.
That was the goal. And we had to figure out how, you know, we wanted to sort of weave it through so it didn't feel like, oh, the fun stuff and then the service stuff, like the work, you know, we wanted it to feel connected because it is connected. So we sort of peppered it throughout.
And a lot of people ask, like, oh, you know, what made you decide to add that in? It was never an add-in. It was always part of the idea of doing this book. It had to have the service, or Mary and I wouldn't have done the book. We didn't want to do the book without that for a couple of reasons. But one is because we care so much about it, and we know that the cast cares so much about it, and the producers too. Like, this was a show where we all really deeply care about the issues and causes that we champion in the book and other ones too. But it was always part of it. There was never going to be this book without.
It felt right. Like, The West Wing is a love letter to public service. So it felt like, well, this book while a really fun ride for Wingnuts, like it's a huge, long, chunky, juicy, fun insider's look at the West Wing, we thought, what if at the same time we could shine a light on these great organizations, you know? And look, most of the readers are probably already doing service in their life. I'm not, you know, everyone sort of has their relationship to that and volunteers and it's not, I feel like Melissa and I feel like we're not telling people to get involved. Most people aren't involved, but it's just, we thought if we could shine a light on these organizations at the very same time people are enjoying their fun Wingnut ride, that would be great. We'd be really happy.
And if we can get them some support and some lift, yay, can help more people. And that's sort of our goal.
And it is what's happening. We're hearing from all the organizations.
Yeah.
This is so great. We're having people contact us and we're getting, you know, donations. And it's been a really nice response.
And we also knew that our fans like that stuff. So it wasn't like we were giving them broccoli. It's part of who everybody is. So we're so excited about the response from the fans to the book. That has been such a gift that people are loving it so much.
That was Melissa Fitzgerald. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And Mary McCormick, thank you.
Thanks. We loved it.
Go buy What's Next. Thank you so much for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.